His hand was at the buckle of his belt as he made his way to the table where Nagsar Inaste lay. The Unslayable One stopped in his tracks as he recalled the moment. Memories of that sight of his humiliated sister overcame him and forced him to seek support from the wall. The first 8 orcs he had killed more quickly than an arrow singing from the bow to its target. Then he had continued the carnage until the last of the beasts lay destroyed at his feet. Dark green blood had flowed like water. The countless acts of violation committed by the orcs against his sister in past cycles had left 5 hideous fruits. When he discovered the bastards in a neighboring cave, he had nearly beheaded them all, but then a groundling had appeared and suggested a pact. A good pact, which he had agreed to. The creatures could be made use of, though he would not spare them once they had fulfilled their role. The Unslayable One struggled for breath and forced himself to walk on. He entered the chamber where his armor was kept. Piece by piece he took it down off the stand and put it on. His thoughts moved to his son, a purebred Sintoit. In order to show his paralyzed sister that he was with her once more, he had made love to her devotedly after he had killed the orcs, giving her the kind of pain and passion that a Sintoit desires. To compensate for the 5 ugly beings that had crawled out of her body, she had then borne him a son. Hundreds of cycles they had waited for such a one. And finally, in the midst of all this horror, the longed-for event had occurred. But on returning from the magic wellspring, disappointment had followed. The sun had turned against him. He did not understand his task and refused to take it on. I hope I can change his mind. Nagsar Inaste must not be disappointed in him. He tightened the final chain. His armor was ready. Now he would have to be watchful and guard the entrances. The scout girl that had escaped would bring the army. But until he had completed his preparations, no soldier should enter the depths of Taboribor. Not until the helpless Nagsar Inaste had opened her eyes. He drew his swords out of their sheaths, studying them in the lamplight. He was pleased to see how immaculate the blades were. In spite of the intense use they had been put to, they showed neither scratches nor notches. "It doesn't matter to them whether they slice through tough flesh or thick iron," he thought, and gave a vicious smile, thinking back to the orcs he had slaughtered. He had sprung among them, his swords taking 3 or 4 lives with 1 swipe, while they had writhed and yelled. "They are simply too slow. They cannot stand up to risen gods. I have never understood why the humans fear them." Those 300 orcs had been the beginning. He put the swords back again in their sheaths. "Only serve me as you have done, my good friends. Let us bring such fear to the humans that they are too dazzled to see our true intentions." The Unslayable One fastened his long black hair back under a black cloth and put his helmet on his head. The beauty of his face, not to be revealed to any other than Nagsar Inaste, disappeared behind the visor. It would be wasted on others. Gerdlegard, the north of the kingdom of Goragar, summer 6241st solar cycle. Even at the beginning now of the cycle's best season, Gerdlegard was wreathed in a sense of depression. Although nature was at its most bountiful, the sun warm, the first harvests in and delicious fruits ripening, promising variety for jaded palates, it was not enough to lighten the mood. In the interim, the human kingdoms had learned of uncanny and terrible events. The rumors did not merely furnish descriptions of the monsters. Each tale spoke of threats and dangers, made greater by 100-fold every time it was retold. "Have you heard? Now it's said they can fly, become invisible and transform themselves into a mountain." Goda rode along a little ahead and to the side of Ironheart and Tungdil. Behind them, there followed a troop of dwarf warriors, male and female. They were escorting the diamond from the Grey Range to Immengau. They had 10 small armored wagons with them, and in each was a newly made imitation of the diamond they were taking to Palland. It had been Tungdil's idea to increase the number of stones in the hope of complicating things for would-be thieves, be they undergroundlings, pink-eyed orcs, monsters, or the immortal Unslayables. The Fourthlings were busy producing yet more copies.
"You forgot to add that one glance is enough to kill a grown man, and that they spit fire," sighed Tungdil.
They heard these stories everywhere. The latest rumour of the return of an Unslayable sovereign, one of the mightiest of the Alfar, had brought deep and widespread fear.
"I can understand the Longans being worried," he mused. "If one of the immortal Alfar had managed to survive the effect of the Star of Judgment, then I would think, if I were a human, that maybe more of them survived."
"That was rumour number 73, said Goda flatly. "There's an army collecting into Borobor ready to send out raiding parties."
Ironheart turned to her in surprise.
"You're really keeping score?"
She grinned.
"Of course. It's helpful to see how quickly a handful of enemies can become an undefeatable army. The monsters got bigger, more terrible, and impossible to vanquish as we moved through the villages. We didn't beat that thing in the vaults, but we could have done."
Tungdil looked back at their troop. All was in order.
"And in the last town, there were the first rumours of a powerful artifact in Palland."
Goda looked at Tungdil.
"People have noticed that soldiers from all the different kingdoms are gathering in the old fortress."
"But no dwarves," muttered Ironheart.
Tungdil knew that this fact, widely known, was fermenting talk about quarrels between dwarves and elves, dwarves and humans, the High King of the Dwarves, and the kings of the human realms.
"Have you heard number 74?
Goda loved being able to tease her master with news.
"These monsters can steal a maidenhead with a single word."
"If I have to listen to this nonsense a moment longer, I shall put wax in my ears," said Boindil bad-temperedly. "You'd almost think people prefer the bad news to the good."
"You may be right there," nodded Goda. "It is a thing the humans do, seeing the bad side rather than praising the good."
"They aren't all like that,"
Tungdil softened the reproof, knowing that what the dwarf girl was saying was largely true. He found it worrying, since she had only recently come into contact much with humans.
"We can hardly tell them the truth, can we? We're lucky the ordinary folk have no idea what the monsters are really after. The secret of the diamond's power has been kept so far."
"Yes, you're right again there."
Boindil slipped from the saddle, preferring to walk beside his small horse. His buttocks were too sore.
"I'll never get used to this way of travelling. It may be quicker, but your bottom gets as broad as the pony you ride on."
Without saying a word, Goda also dismounted. She was persevering with Ironheart's instructions and was capable now of physical feats that surprised both of the dwarfs. If Tungdil were not mistaken, there had been a slight change in his friend's attitude toward the girl. He looked at her more often than before, and did so not without the eyes of a master observing an apprentice, but with the eyes of dwarf attracted to dwarf woman, like now.
"Does she please you?"
he asked with a smile.
"What?"
Boindil jerked upright and even blushed a little. He immediately turned his gaze to the road.
"In the progress she's making,"
said Tungdil, making the question more objective.
"Oh, yes, of course,"
answered Boindil in relief. He looked at his friend.
"That's not what you meant, is it?"
Tungdil only grinned and pointed to the wood on their left. It had to be the easternmost point of Alandor, or, at least, it was composed of the same trees that grew in the elf groves.
"It's time for a break."
He had the troop stop in the cool shade and rest a while. Even if the children of the smith regularly did guard duty on the surface, a long march such as this was unusual for most of them. Iarhart left Goda to keep watch. When they had moved away from her, he took up the thread once more.
"You were right, scholar," he sighed. "It makes me happy to see her, and I am dreading the day when she leaves."
"You will have her with you for a long time yet. It will take cycles for a good warrior girl to be trained." Tungdil winked, but then he grew serious. "You've really fallen for her." Boindil sat down, one hand on his weapon.
"It's crazy, isn't it? My heart is on fire. It was her that reawoke my lust for fighting. And I know that it can't go anywhere. I killed a relative of hers. Goda will never see me any other way. She will hate me. I can sense it, even though she hides her true feelings."
Tungdil thought back to the conversation with Belindis. He did not tell his friend that Goda had originally arrived with the intention of killing him. Now would not be a good time to tell him that. Instead, he said,
"I wouldn't be so sure." "Oh, do you think she likes me? After I murdered her grandma?"
"You'll have to find out."
"Do you know how long it's been since I courted a dwarf girl, scholar?"
Iarhart gave a helpless sigh.
"Somebody told me that you have to rub them with their favourite cheese and then spin them round four times to win their heart,"
laughed Tungdil, citing the not entirely serious advice the twin dwarf had once given him.
"But really, just be yourself."
Those had been Bowen Dahl's words of wisdom. "She's a thirdling. She has no clan, no family. That should make it easier for you. You don't have to impress or convince anybody else." He thought back ruefully to when he had first spoken to the father of Belindis. He had been rejected out of hand, but in the end she had remained resolute and had left husband and clan for his sake and for their love. Now the bond between them was breaking, and the recriminations that he levelled at himself could not be dismissed. He felt he had betrayed her, but knew they could no longer live as man and wife.
"Oh, Vrakus," said Iarhart despairingly. "It's all too much. An honest fight and you know where you are. But this love stuff is complicated."
Tungdil did not envy his friend's state of mind and hoped that things would work out for him.
"Stick with it and wait for the right moment."
He clapped him on the shoulder. "And whatever you do, don't listen to what others in your clan have to say about it." Iarhart grinned.
"Oh, I have no reputation left to lose. You forget, I'm a friend of yours, scholar."
A rider was approaching them from the south. At first, given the rider's size, they took it to be a child on horseback, but they soon saw they were mistaken. Dark clothing, a scarf round the neck, full of saddlebags clanking.
"The executioner again?"
Boindil was surprised.
"Can't just be coincidence."
"It won't be coincidence."
"Then send him packing if he tries to join us here. I don't trust him." "Wait and see."
Bramdil pulled up his horse where Tungdil and Boindil were resting.
"Greetings!" He laughed down at them. "Mind if I join you for a breather?"
"So, have you finished your business in Parista?"
To Boindil's surprise, Tungdil gestured for him to sit with them.
"We've got some tea if you want."
"Great."
Bramdil reached behind and pulled out a kind of rope ladder. He stepped onto it out of the stirrup, and from there down onto the grass.
"Neat, eh?" he grinned. "I thought, why should a dwarf go slowly on a pony when he can go fast on a horse? So I came up with this contraption and got the saddle made."
Iarhart shook his head and looked up. The executioner had chosen a particularly tall mount.
"You won't get me up on one of those. But there's a very good view."
Bramdil followed Tungdil over to where the tea was brewing.
"Thanks."
Don't mention it. What brings you to the north? Asked Tungdil.
I'm heading back to Hilchester.
Bramdil blew gently on his hot tea.
King Broron wants me to start a school.
For executioners, I assume?
Absolutely. I didn't want it to be in Parista for fear of tarnishing his new capital city's reputation,
grinned the dwarf.
Although I only carry out the letter of the law.
Odd, isn't it? The humans set the death penalty and then want nothing to do with it.
Tungdil smiled. We didn't come across each other in Parista.
No, I'll have been too busy, Bramdil winked. You don't believe me. What do you think, then? That I'm a spy for the dwarf haters?
Yes,
Ireheart jumped in, his hands on the crow's beak handle. Bramdil laughed out loud, sounding genuinely amused. His gaze went past the warrior over to Goda, and his curiosity was aroused.
A fine-looking dwarf girl. She looks nice and strong. I bet she wields her weapon with a strong hand, excellent material for an executioner. Leave her alone,
was Boindil's immediate response.
She is my pupil,
he added quickly.
If she's going to be doing any beheading, then it'll be orc heads that roll.
He was getting hot and bothered, the blood surging in his ears. Was it jealousy?
I understand. Your pupil,
said Bramdil with a grin, leaving his true meaning unspoken. He sipped his tea.
I was talking to Gordislan Hammerfist in Parista. He's worried about Trovegold. It's been attacked.
Tungdil let out his breath.
Thirdling machines?
No, it was sabotage. Bramdil looked serious. The sluice on the dam was jammed full open, and a third of Trovegold left underwater. The townspeople eventually managed to repair the damaged sluice. Otherwise, even more of the freelings would have drowned. How many were lost?
Ireheart wanted to know.
211. More than 30 houses will have to be rebuilt.
He lowered his eyes despondently.
No, it wasn't the dwarf haters' machines. They can't reach us through the cave network. They're using other methods of attack.
He poured himself some more tea.
The worst thing is, there's no one to actually blame. The guards out at the sluice were all killed. Nobody saw the murderers. That's terrible.
Tungdil was moved.
The flood means Trovegold is a hotbed of suspicion now. There are accusations it was the clan dwarves and not the thirdlings at all. They think wealth is causing envy amongst the dwarf folks. They all want Afrakasium and gold. One of the dwarves in the Fourthling clan assembly is supposed to have said we were trying to curry favour with Vrakas with all these sacrifices and donations, and that it's unfair and has got to be stopped. Others suggested the leaders wanted to enforce the dwarves back into the dwarf realms again.
Bramdil was silent, waiting for a reaction.
Rubbish! Thundered Ireheart. The mountains have enough gold to fill that town's entire cave. Why would the secondlings, or whoever, want the outcast's gold?
Tungdil leaned back against a tree, closing his eyes. Soon the thirdlings will be getting the blame whenever anything happens. Suspicion will be rampant, and no one will trust anyone anymore.
That's just what the dwarf haters wanted, of course.
He looked up.
Bramdil, wherever you hear talk like that, tell them to pay no attention. The more discord there is, the quicker the dwarf haters will have achieved their goal.
The executioner nodded.
That's what Gordislan Hammerfish said. I'm sure you know how hard it is to put such rumours down.
He placed his empty cup on the grass.
I'll be off. Perhaps we'll meet again. If we do, you mustn't think straight away I'm one of the bad ones,
he said to Ireheart. He got up and climbed onto his horse again. With his boot, he fished for the patent ladder. pulling it up behind him.
May Vrakus bless you.
He lifted his hand in farewell and rode off. Tungdil and Boindil watched him go.
Do you know what gets me?
Tungdil asked his friend. He never wanted to know what we've got in the wagons.
I was right. He's definitely a spy.
Boindil stood determined, hands on his hips. Tungdil smiled.
Because he fancied Goda. No, said the twin. Well, yes, because of that too, he sighed. Master! Tungdil! Called Goda. Over here, I found something.
Perhaps it's your heart, Tungdil teased Ireheart, who jabbed him in the ribs.
Let's hear no more of this sentimental nonsense, he growled, getting up and running over.
Tungdil followed him. It was still strange to see his friend without his long black braided plait. Goda was kneeling by a bush, and she pushed the branches apart when the two dwarves came over.
Look!
Amongst the foliage and purple flowers, elf features were visible. The elf lay as if dead, with eyes closed and a few withered leaves on his face. There were three arrows sticking out from the elf's chest. The arrows had penetrated the leather armor and earth-colored clothing under it. Judging by the splendor of the finely embroidered garments, this must be a high-status elf. The fact he wore only a limited amount of armor suggested he had been hunting. His camp was probably not far away.
"He's breathing," said Ireheart, astonished, as he saw the chest move almost imperceptibly. "Well, these pointy... I mean, these elves are tougher than they look."
"Give me a hand." Tungdil was sitting the injured elf up carefully so he could inspect the arrows. Two broke off. The third was still in the body.
"By Vrakus! Those are elf arrows!" "If it were one arrow, I'd think it was an accident," said Ireheart.
He studied the elf's blood-stained back.
"But with three, I'd say it's out of the question. Unless they choose to hunt their own kind. Why would elves be killing each other?"
Tungdil looked at the face. "Or perhaps we should be asking, why did they want to kill him?"
"The arrows could be a trick, forgeries," suggested Goda. "The thirdlings, perhaps."
"No, they'd have used crossbows to put the blame on us, and they'd have dragged the body somewhere more public. And they wouldn't have left the poor devil alive," replied Tungdil. "No, this elf has been shot by his own kind. Either they've left him for dead, or he ran away and they lost him."
Boindil regarded their unusual find.
"What shall we do with him? Those wounds are deep. He's not going to last long."
Tungdil glanced at the wagons. "We'll take him with us. If the elves wanted him dead, I want to know the reason." He couldn't remember reading about any internal strife in Alandor, but the strange conduct of the elf delegates, their secret message in invisible ink, the stone, those new buildings that had been kept hidden, they could all have some connection to this injured elf. Perhaps it was a question of a personal vendetta, or a high-ranking criminal who'd been challenged and pursued. No one knew how the elf folk managed their own affairs in the forests and groves. Anything was possible.
"Let's make sure he stays alive and can open his eyes soon."
Tungdil called some of the other soldiers over so they could help carry the elf. They put him in one of the wagons, cushioning him on furs and skins. One of their healers saw to his wounds. Tungdil gave the troop the order to move on. He wanted to make good use of the rest of the orbit's sunlight to get as far as possible away from Alandor's borders. It was not forbidden to transport injured elves in wagons, but it wasn't the normal thing for a dwarf to be doing. If the worst came to the worst, the dwarves might be accused of kidnapping. So the troop trundled off toward the south with what now was a doubly sensitive cargo. Whether he wanted to or not, Ireheart had to get back in the saddle again. Otherwise he'd be slowing everyone down, and as Goda did not seem to mind riding, he kept quiet himself. It would not make a good impression for the master to be making a fuss if the pupil was not complaining.
"Who was the dwarf you were talking to?" she inquired.
"No one you need to know about,"
Ironheart replied rudely. Goda raised her eyebrows.
"A child of the smith, riding on a full-size horse? Unusual."
"He's not unusual. He's an executioner."
Boindil was unsettled by her curiosity.
"He kills criminals for the Longans, for money."
"Is his name Bramdel Masterstroke?"
she asked excitedly.
Ironheart growled. "Yes. Why?"
"I've heard a lot about him. He fought at Black Saddle and in Parista, they say. He killed 90 orcs all by himself, and 100 avatars," she enthused. "I'd love to meet him."
"Pah! That's nothing compared to what Tungdil and I have done, or compared with the number of snout-faced orcs we two split down the middle."
He turned round in the saddle to face her.
"Forget about Bramdel. He may be a legend in his time, but not in my eyes. Don't trust him. Now, no more talk of him."
She stared at him in surprise.
"Yes, master."
She looked helplessly over to Tungdil, who shrugged his shoulders to say it was none of his business. When the sun gave way to the night, Tungdil led his troop to the bank of a swift-flowing river so that they could not be attacked from all sides at once. He wasn't happy near water because it brought back too many disturbing personal memories, but the security of their mission was paramount. The team were lifting down the injured elf and starting to release the ponies from their traces. That's when it happened. The ponies whinnied, and one after another reared up, kicking and pulling away. With nothing to restrain them now, they made off along the riverbank as if pursued by invisible spirits. Tungdil knew why they had suddenly panicked and bolted. He had seen tiny bunches of feathers in the animals' flanks, blowpipe arrows. And arrows did not just happen. Enemies had been following unseen, hard on their heels, waiting for an opportunity to strike.
"To arms!" he called. "Undergroundlings!"
Ironheart and Goda hurried over while the other dwarves raced after the runaway wagons.
"Why do you say undergroundlings?"
Boindil asked his friend. He looked around but saw nothing. 30 dwarves were at their side now, axes and shields at the ready, but there was nobody to fight yet.
"It might have been Bramdel."
"No. The ponies were shot at with blowpipes to make them bolt," he said. "We didn't see the attackers. That means they could just as easily have killed a lot of us. But they didn't." Shouts and frenzied whinnying caught their attention. The entire mounted unit had crashed to the ground, ponies struggling in the dust. A rope had been spanned across their path at knee height, abruptly stopping their pursuit. Some were stunned or unable to rise, but the others jumped bravely back into the saddle despite their cuts and bruises and took off after the wagons.
"It was a trap," growled Ironheart,
his head down between his shoulders.
"Come out here, you barefaced cowards!" he yelled, stepping forward in challenge. "That's not how a dwarf fights. If you've a proper dwarf amongst you, come out, instead of skulking in the undergrowth like some scurvy gnome."
There was a rustling and cracking in the reeds 20 paces off. Ironheart's eyes flashed.
"We're off to mow a meadow, Goda."
He stormed off, the dwarf girl following boldly. In Tungdil's imagination, there rose the image of the dead twin Boendal at his friend's side in the place of the young thirdling girl. With Goda trained to the peak of perfection, these two would make as good a fighting partnership as the brothers had always done.
"After them!" he commanded. "Try not to kill any undergroundlings. They have spared us harm where they could."
A posse fanned out into the mass of thin grasses that stood 4 times as high as their heads. Tungdil hoped they would find one of the strange dwarves. Otherwise, there was no chance of regaining the diamonds they had already lost to the undergroundlings. The further they moved in amongst the tall grasses, the paler that hope became. They had reached the far side of the reeds without coming across a soul.
"Over there!"
called Goda, pointing to a figure heading for an incline to the side of the grass stalks. Taller than a dwarf, but too small to be a human. Tungdil swung round and chased after the undergroundling, Goda and Ironheart at his side. The other dwarfs were too far away to overtake their quarry. The fugitive disappeared over the brow of the hill, the three dwarfs in hot pursuit, not losing or gaining any ground all the while.
"This isn't working," muttered Boindil, raising his crow's beak hammer and hurling it as he ran. "Fly, hammer, and stop him," he called after it.
Whirling round in circles during flight, the heavy weapon covered the intervening distance with ease. The blunt end hit the undergroundling on the thigh, bringing him to the ground. He slid downhill on the slippery wet grass and lay there groaning.
"A masterly throw,"
Tungdil complimented him. He had been afraid the weapon's mighty spur, as long as a forearm, would bury itself in the undergroundling's back and kill him stone dead. Ever since Ironheart had regained his love of fighting, there was no holding him back.
"Never throw your weapon unless you have a spare one with you,"
Goda mocked.
"Master, you..."
"Oh, not so fast."
Boindil raised his broad fist.
"I've still got these two weapons, pupil mine. They're quite sufficient for an opponent like this one. If it was orcs, I'd have had to think of something else."
"You're making excuses," she complained. "If I'd done that, you'd have made me drag heavy beams about or do some other useless task."
"Yes," he admitted with a laugh. "That's because I'm the master."
They reached the injured undergroundling, who was trying to sit up. Tungdil knelt by him and laid him back down.
"Take it easy," he said reassuringly. "We don't mean you any harm."
It was a dwarf, definitely, even if there was no beard. Even if the facial features were much harder, the stature somewhat taller, and the skin darker than usual. The hair was braided and dyed dark green, dark blue and black. It grew back from the middle of the skull, with the hairless brow displaying tattooed designs. He wore no armor. The only protection against weather and weapons alike was thick leather clothing. On his feet were thin-soled leather boots. And one of those very boots delivered a sharp kick to Tungdil's chin, sending him flying. As he fell backwards, he heard Ironheart shout out. Then his friend landed in a heap on top of him, his nose streaming blood.
"He kicked me,"
said Ironheart, amazed, wiping the blood away.
"The scoundrel kicked me like a dog."
He sprang up in a fury.
"I'll tear him apart with my bare hands, the baldy patch."
Tungdil stood up and saw the undergroundling was escaping with practiced ease from the wrestling holds Goda was attempting. In a swift counter-move, he gripped her forearm and shoulder and used her own body weight to throw her. She crashed to the ground.
"Don't kill him, Boindil," he shouted.
Ironheart's wild attack would not go well, at least not for the warrior twin. In fact, the undergroundling moved neatly and fast, as if dancing with his opponent. As soon as an opportunity presented itself, he would grab a handhold on a belt or the mail shirt and use the leverage it gave him. This time, it was the weapon belt. Ironheart was lifted up again, crashing down onto his front, cursing so viciously that the setting sun had to seek the shelter of the nearby clouds.
"He's cracked my bones," he shouted, pounding the grass with his fist. "By Vrakas, what a bastard! That's not fighting. That's kobold tricks."
The undergroundling limped off at a run. Tungdil chased him, glad he had got back his old stamina. 40 orbits ago, he would not have been able to run like this and would have collapsed in a gasping heap.
"Stop! We need to talk about the diamonds," he called. "They're important for us."
The undergroundling certainly wasn't paying any attention to his words, but Boindil's hammer throw had taken its toll. After 200 paces on the open plain, Tungdil got close enough to launch himself on his opponent, bringing him down. But even as they fell, the undergroundling, with remarkable agility and slippery as an eel, turned and twisted under him, and would have escaped if Goda had not whacked him over the head with the handle of her Nightstar flail. He sank down, unconscious.
"Thanks, Goda,"
gasped Tungdil, sitting on top of their captive to tie him up, hand and foot using their belts. He wouldn't get away now. When he searched the undergroundling's pockets, he found a number of the red-feathered blowpipe arrows, and a little bottle with an evil-smelling liquid, which he assumed was a poison for the arrow tips. Ironheart lumbered up.
"Next time he'll have to use a proper weapon for a proper dwarf," he said crossly, holding his left hand pressed against his chest.
He examined the captive with his eyes.
"What? Only a dagger?"
The undergroundling's eyelids fluttered and opened. He did not struggle any more, knowing that escape was impossible now. He studied the faces of his captors.
"Let me go,"
he said in a striking low voice with a harsh accent. It sounded aristocratic, like the tones Rodario sometimes adopted to make fun of people.
"I've done nothing to you." "Done nothing?"
Ironheart pointed to his right shoulder.
"You've dislocated my shoulder with your damned wrestling throws. You tried to kill me. If I had wanted to kill you, I would have done so," was the reply. "So don't complain."
Ironheart laughed in disbelief.
"Hark at that! By Vracus, have you been chewing on the old Halto herb?"
Tungdil signalled to him not to go overboard. Goda stepped up to her master's side and was granted a look of grateful praise, because it was down to her that they even had a captive to interrogate. Her proud smile calmed him in a trice.
"I am Tungdil Golhand. This is Boindil Doubleblade, and this, Goda Flameheart. Many of our people have lost friends and family in trying to protect the diamond that you want to steal from us. What is it about?"
Some of the other dwarves had come up to join them now. Someone told Tungdil in a whisper that the wagons had been found. The chests containing the stones had all been broken open, and the stones had gone.
"We don't steal. We take back what is rightfully ours," said the undergroundling. "It was a broker that took them and carried them off. We had been searching for many star courses before the Ubariu told us where they were."
"What's a broker?"
He thought for a while before replying.
"You'd say elf woman."
Tungdil nodded to Ironheart.
"As I thought.
We called her Eoil, and she brought terror to Girdlegard, but she gave the stone amazing power."
"It always was a powerful artifact," the undergroundling responded. "And it doesn't alter the fact that the diamond's ours."
"Can you take us to your leader?"
Tungdil untied the belt on the captive's hands, and then the bonds round his feet, and stood back up.
"Your attacks must stop. We all need a solution."
He held out his hand to help him up.
"Scholar, they're in league with the orcs," Ironheart warned. "I don't think we can trust them."
The undergroundling pretended not to hear the objection and stood up without taking the proffered hand.
"I'll take you where you can wait for Sundalon. That's all."
He brushed the grass off his clothing.
"The three of us will come with you. You take the lead."
Tungdil gave orders for the others to wait back at camp.
"Do you have a name?"
"Yes, I do."
He nodded and limped off. Boindil was pleased about the limp. It made up for the appalling pain in his arm. Suddenly he felt Goda's hand on his right shoulder. Her other hand grasped his arm, forcing it backwards. He gritted his teeth as the bone slotted back into its socket. For one moment their faces were very close. He could feel her breath on his skin.
"Forgive me, master. The less time you have to tense up, the easier it is to deal with the dislocation."
"It's fine,"
he said, and smiled at her. Not as her master, but as a dwarf. a dwarf in love. Then he cleared his throat, moved swiftly to the side and stepped past her.
Come on, let's catch up. We don't want to abandon the scholar.
Goda had noticed the difference in the smile. That would explain his overreaction when she had gone on about Bramdel.
Oh, Vrakas.
She gave a deep sigh and followed.
Girdlegard, Kingdom of Goregar, 38 miles west of Perista, summer, 6241st solar cycle. The wagons hurtled through the landscape. The Curiosum had seldom been in such a tearing hurry to get to the next venue. The reason was obvious. Fergus must inform the rulers what had happened on the Thirdling Island. But there was going to be a real problem with that.
And he still hasn't spoken a word? Tassia asked again as she sat next to her lover on the driving seat of the first wagon, tossed about as the vehicle rattled along.
So he's just sitting around mending props and his theatre gadgets from the old days?
Yep. His mind is busy trying to forget what he's gone through these past five cycles.
Rodario slowed the wagon. He had seen a place off the road where they could camp for the night. It was important none of the vehicles damaged an axle now when the end of the journey was practically in sight. They made a circle with the caravans. Rodario helped Tassia down and tried, though not very hard, to avoid looking down her cleavage.
Oh, now I know what I've been missing.
He grinned and then kissed her. She laughed and tapped him with a pile of papers she had been sitting on. And how many women did you gladden in Mithridania while I was busy taking my troop north?
Your troop, eh? He said with emphasis, crossing his arms over his chest. I'm back now, my girl, and I'll have you know that I'm in charge of the Curiosum again. Or have you been inciting the troop to revolution with your pretty eyes and your charming mouth?
She placed a forefinger under his chin.
That is the way of it, my love. I've slept with every man in the theatre company and made them all my slaves. The women never liked me in the first place. You may be the emperor of the acting fraternity, but there's a new queen in the realm.
Tassia was only half speaking in jest. Rodario had certainly noticed that his instructions were only carried out when Tassia gave the nod. He thought it was a joke at first.
No, you don't mean it, he said uncertainly.
Have another look at your play. I've changed it a bit. It's better now. She spoke confidently and pressed the papers into his hand, grinning at him. She planted a passionate kiss on his lips, then hurried off to help Geyser with the meal.
Rodario watched her go and scratched his head.
That woman has a demon in her blood, he muttered. If I'd known that before, I'd never have agreed to the deal back in Storm Valley.
He went round to the back door of the caravan and let down the ladder to sit on, while the crew took the horses out of the shafts and led them off to be fed and watered. In the light of the setting sun, he skimmed through what Tassia had changed on his play script. He was annoyed to find himself laughing out loud at several of the new ideas she had added. She had certainly shown her talents here. Rodario had come across many works by experienced playwrights that were nowhere as good as this. He surfaced eventually as thirst and concern for Fergus made themselves felt. He got up and went up the narrow steps.
Fergus!
While he waited for an answer, he turned his head to watch Tassia. She was laughing with Geyser. The women were having a potato-peeling race. Anyone in the troop who was not busy with other work had gathered at the fireside to be near the warmth of this delightful girl. Rodario realized that she had been telling the truth. The Curiosum was now securely in Tassia's strong and capable hands. He had trained her. She had been his muse.
By Palandiel, I can't have that, murmured the dethroned emperor. I must have a quiet word with the young lady.
He was starting back down the steps when he heard a moan coming from the caravan.
Fergus?
He opened the door without further ado. His friend was lying on the floor, covered in blood. Fergus had slashed his own wrists with deep lengthwise cuts and had fainted from the blood loss.
What the?
Rodario rushed in, grabbed a sheet, and tore it into strips to bind the gashes.
What are you thinking of? He yelled at Fergus, pulling him upright. I didn't rescue you just so you could kill yourself.
It's the guilt, whispered Fergus. I built machines designed to bring death to the dwarves. He was struggling to regain control. He swayed again, but Rodario had him fast.
Go easy on yourself, my friend. They forced you to do it. I could have killed myself instead of doing what they demanded, but...
He looked the actor in the eyes.
First, they sent drilling rigs through the old blocked mine galleries, trying to get through. Then the death machines followed.
He wiped his eyes.
The machines!
Rodario gave him a cup of water.
Take it easy. I can't take it easy. Have you heard what the people are saying? Those monsters of flesh and steel.
He swallowed, his hands gripping the cup convulsively.
They are all my work. The Thirdlings are in league with the immortal siblings, he said, trying to keep his voice level.
Rodario felt icy fingers up and down his spine.
No.
He saw Tassia's face at the door, not moving lest she intrude. She stood in the doorway listening.
Yes!
Fergus gave a bitter laugh.
Bandilor came to me and showed me some weird sketches of disgusting hybrid creatures to be made partly of iron. He had the formula for the alloy that can conduct magic and had stolen some of the embers from the Fifthling's dragon forge. He used that to make the alloy, and I made the machines from it following his instructions. I built them, not knowing what he wanted to do with them.
He turned pale.
Then they came. I remember exactly. We came to the surface, and they were brought to us. Ugly little bastard hybrids of orc and alf. The biggest no older than 4 cycles. Bandilor took the island to a secret location somewhere in the lake and sank it to the bottom. Then we put the bastards in the machines, screwed and hammered them all up tight, cut off their limbs, and attached in their place the things Bandilor brought. Glass or crystals, I don't know which. He pushed the rods of magic-conducting metal through the small bodies and threw the little bastards into a hole he had dug. They screamed, oh, how they screamed.
He shuddered with the horror of the images he was bringing to mind.
Green lightning shot up, out of the hole, and into the iron. Alphar runes flamed and flared, and these hybrids, they crew and they screeched. Their bodies became fused with the contraptions. With my contraptions.
He emptied the cup.
I don't know how long it took. Then Bandilor had the island brought up to the surface, and I never saw the creatures again. Till we heard about them on the journey.
He fell silent. All about them was quiet for a time. Tassia had goosebumps all over as her imagination conjured up these horrific beings, filling her with terror.
Ye gods! She breathed. How awful!
Rodario, too, needed some time to recover from what he had heard. His own technical theatre genius had created his masterpieces. Masterpieces of destruction and cruelty, driven by evil and suffused with the will to wreak havoc and death.
You are not the guilty one, he breathed finally,
helping Fergus over to the bed to sit down. He poured out wine, which his friend gulped down. Fergus was shaking all over.
I don't deserve to live, Rodario, he said despairingly. Of course the Thirdlings forced me to do these things, but I carried out my tasks with precision. I did my work only too well.
He clenched his fists.
All the time I was thinking about Namora and my children.
I serve the Thirdlings well in order to avenge myself on the dwarfs and on Girdlegard for what happened when they took my family. Only toward the end did I realize what harm I was causing to humans, elves, and dwarfs."
He emptied the wine glass and closed his eyes.
"I feel giddy," he whispered and fell sideways onto the pillows.
Wine and blood loss were taking their toll.
"Sleep as long as you can," Rodario told his friend kindly.
He covered him with a blanket and wiped the blood from the floor. He would scrub the floorboards later.
"And don't touch the knives."
He left the caravan, pulling the door to behind him. He sat himself on the steps with a bottle of wine and watched the last rays of the setting sun. He took a swig of wine and passed the bottle to Tassia.
"What did he mean about his family being taken?" she asked hesitatingly. "I thought it had happened at the Battle of Perista."
He put his arm around her and pulled her to him, looking her deep in the eyes, imagining all of a sudden what it would be like to lose her forever. He felt a wave of fear surge through his being. He kissed her tenderly. Tassia was aware of the difference between this and his usual passionate embraces. A kiss now, not of desire, but of such deep emotion that not even a poet would have been able to describe it. She smiled at him and put her hand to his face.
"What was that for?"
Rodario sighed.
"His life's companion, Namora, was a half-elf. She fought with us on the side of good against Nodon, and then was apprenticed to the last of the Magi, Andukai the Tempestuous. She took the Magi's place and protected Girdlegard from Avatars and the Eoil. But in return for her efforts, the elf part of her was burnt to ashes. The Star of Judgment knew no mercy, not for her."
"Or her children?"
Tassia continued, shocked and saddened.
"How terrible! Poor Fergus!"
"After the battle, he blamed dwarves and humans alike for their deaths. If they had let the Avatars have their way, he used to say in his utter despair, there would have been fewer victims in Girdlegard. They would have destroyed the evil in the form of the Alphar, and then they would have withdrawn, without letting the Star of Judgment rise. And he could have been a contented father."
He looked past her to the red of the dying sun.
"Sometimes I wonder if perhaps he was right."
She was silent, took a mouthful of wine and passed the bottle back to him.
"I'd be lying if I said I'd understood him at the time. Now I'm able to imagine what it must have been like for him."
He stretched out a hand to stroke her hair.
"I pray to the gods I'll never be put in that situation. Like him, I should hate and hunt down, to the end of my days, anyone who caused me such pain."
She took his hand and laid it on her cheek. So they sat until darkness fell. Rodario looked in on the patient, now sleeping soundly. Then he and Tassia moved over to the campfire to join the rest of the troop, where they sat, arms around each other, listening to Geysa sing. Girdlegard, Kingdom of Goregar, Fortress Cowburg, Summer 6241st Solar Cycle. Balba Chiselstrike from the Secondling clan of the Stone Teasers was feeling a little out of place amongst all these humans. Queen Issachar's direction that no dwarf be allowed inside the walls of the castle she found ridiculous. She could not understand the ruler's fear. The humans, it was clear to Balba, would be completely lost without the fighting power of the dwarf peoples. In spite of her resentment, she intended to carry out her task conscientiously, supervising the completion of defense works with the foreman. She was checking every stone in Palin's bastion walls.
"It's a wonderful fort, isn't it?"
the man said admiringly.
"No, it isn't."
Balba smashed his complacency.
"It's ugly. The whole construction lacks grace and has been thrown uncaringly at the landscape. The old builders always planned meticulously, but they never considered aesthetics.
Her condemnation wiped the foreman's good mood straight off his face. As a descendant of Palin's original builders, he felt this was a personal attack.
You dwarves all think you can do everything better.
I never said we would have done it better.
Balba knew her people would indeed have done it better, but refrained from saying so.
I miss here the soul that every dwarf building has. The humans who built Palin hewed the stones into shape without paying attention to the strata and structure of the rock. Instead of listening to the grain and fitting the stones so that they last forever, an artificial mountain, the builders have forced the stone, violated it. That is why our buildings last longer than yours.
Balba and all dwarf masons knew the characteristics of every type of rock, from granite to slate, from basalt to marble or sandstone. By the light of the setting sun, she promptly discovered a damaged stone.
Hey, you there?
She called over one of the workmen the king had supplied her with. She pointed out a finial on the passageway arch to the main building.
I told you to take that one out and replace it.
We haven't had time, Balba. We had to...
Right. I'll explain to King Bruron when that stone starts to shake and the arch falls around his ears at the first fanfare.
She put her hands on her hips. She was not going to be changing her mind. The foreman sprang to the defense of his worker.
I'll get a couple of people over and start work at once, Balba, he said, lowering his head so that she would not see the scowl.
He hurried off, glad to escape her harsh tongue. The dwarf woman shook her brown hair back and adjusted her leather apron.
Humans, she muttered and walked off.
When she thought how many cycles the fortress had stood and the neglect it had been subject to, the dilapidated condition she and King Bruron had found it in, then she could really be quite pleased with the work they had done here. The outer walls, laid out in a star shape, were 20 paces high and had been repaired and topped out with sturdy new battlements. It had been a masterwork to replace the crumbling stones without any walls collapsing. The humans had not thought it would be possible. She, the dwarf, had shown them what was what. She had decided to pull down the ruined towers with the weathered stone broken up for use as missiles, piled now on the top walkways and in heaps next to the catapults. The walls were high enough to serve without towers, but she had put up ramps to use for the spear throwers. She was surprised how easily the humans were satisfied with the work. The critical eye of a dwarf would have been much more demanding about standards. She was determined to get Palland into a state that made even the elves praise the speed at which the work had been completed. Not its beauty, but the speed and thoroughness of the work. So far, only one of the remaining diamonds had arrived safely in the fortress. Queen Wei and her soldiers were already here. The messengers sent out from the other groups heading for the fortress were keeping the commanders informed of their progress. It looked as if Sangpur's jewel would be the next to arrive. It would be placed in a room with walls many paces thick. Balba had had the roof reinforced and had put in extra supporting pillars. Even the comet that had once hit the outer lands would not destroy this granite armor. The dwarf directed her steps to the walkway that faced south. She wanted to see the size of Queen Umalanti's force approaching from the hot desert lands, the army protecting her diamond. As she stood on the battlement walkway taking a drink of water from her flask, an armored elf came up to her.
Greetings, he said.
Greetings.
She knew that he had arrived with the 200-strong contingent sent as an advance party from Alandor. Other soldiers would follow. Apart from them, there were 1,000 fighting men from Weyen in the fortress. The rest, a further 15,000 infantry and 2,000 mounted troops led by Prince Malin, were advancing swiftly toward Idoslane to storm Toboribor and to destroy the unslayables and the monsters in those caves. Now that they had shown themselves, there was finally something to attack.
Satalia has sent us a fine day. The elf addressed the air as he looked down toward the wall beneath them.
The goddess looks after her own.
He took off his helmet, letting his pale gold hair shine on his shoulders.